From awaytogarden.com and robinhoodradio.com, this is Away to Garden with Margaret Roach, your weekly invitation to dig in and grow.
Since I've lived full-time in a rural place the last decade, I find that probably not coincidentally, my reading list tends increasingly toward tales of the natural world. The new book, Saving Tarboo Creek, One Family's Quest to Heal the Land, made it to the top of the pile recently, and I want to tell you about it and introduce its author, biologist Scott Freeman. But first, this message.
Underwriting support from Timber Press, your go-to resource for books in gardening and nature. Whether you're a new gardener, a professional at the top of your field, or a reader interested in the wonders of the natural world, their books are there to help you grow. TimberPress.com.
Scott Freeman is principal lecturer in biology at the University of Washington and author of various biology textbooks, but more to today's point, he recently wrote Saving Tarboo Creek. It's at once a tale of his family's 17-acre project that involves salmon and reforestation and tackling invasive species and more, but it's also about how each of us can engage in a role of stewardship with the earth and about how to live a more present and engaged life as a citizen of the planet. So better than try to explain that further myself, let's welcome Scott Freeman to the program. How are you?
I'm great. Thanks so much, Margaret.
I enjoyed the book so much. And at first, you know, I have to say, I started reading and it's about salmon and I'm thinking, I'm reading a book about salmon. And it was my first fish book, but it's not a book about salmon. But it is, but it isn't. Right?
That's right. Yeah, it's a book that's salmon are one of the common threads of the project, but yeah, you're right. It's really, I hope it's
exactly.
Much more than that.
So let's tell people a little bit, first of all, about sort of Saving Tarboo Creek. The book is illustrated by your wife, Susan Leopold Freeman, who's granddaughter of a famous conservationist. So let's sort of explain the genealogy a little bit, because it's magical, kind of, that you did this book together, isn't it?
Yeah, it's something this project and then the book is something we've been dreaming about for a long time. The story actually goes back to 1935 when Susan's grandfather bought a worn-out farm, Dust Bowl Farm, that had been abandoned in central Wisconsin. And he and his kids and wife set out to bring it back to what he called a state of health.
Mm-hmm.
And so they were some of the first people ever on the planet in history who set about replanting native trees and prairie grasses that were native to that region. And from this sort of worn-out, godforsaken patch of 80 acres in 1935, it's just a spectacular landscape now. So that was my wife's heritage. We actually met and fell in love at that spot.
He's Aldo Leopold, yes?
Yes, that's Aldo Leopold, right. Considered kind of the godfather of the international conservation movement.
And he wrote a book in, I think, 1949, A Sand County Almanac, is that right?
Yes, it's become a classic. It sold over, I think, 2 million copies and been translated into 13 languages.
And you say in Saving Tarboo Creek, you say that you reread your grandfather-in-law's book every few years, and you're struck by the desperate tone, and you use the word desperate tone in it. You say he's, quote, a prophet crying out in the wilderness. So, you know, one could say things are even worse now, this many years later, but in Saving Tarboo Creek, somehow it seems to have an optimism.
You're getting to exactly what I hope is the heart of the book. So I wanted to tell readers a story about what is happening on the planet, and there can be a note, as you said exactly, you captured it, a note of desperation, and then that's the big change from Aldo Leopold's day. He was looking at what was happening to Wisconsin and Iowa and the United States in general, and now it's gone international, so there is that sort of desperate edge of the scale of the problems. But the optimism comes in what thousands or maybe millions of people are doing around the planet locally. In their own neighborhoods, in their own gardens, in their own sort of little wild patches that are near them, to heal the land.
Yes, and that word healing is in the subtitle and in some of the what we would call blurbs, the cover blurbs by people who recommend the book and so forth. So healing's a big deal. What was in need of healing when you came to this 17 acres? How many generations? 2 generations later, from Aldo Leopold.
Well, we When Susan and I met at the Leopold property in Wisconsin, we had always dreamed about doing a project like that ourselves. Mm-hmm. And in 2004, we finally got organized enough to look for a project, and we found Tarboo Creek, and we wanted to take on a place that had been beat up and degraded and abused, but we were a little taken aback at the shape of Tarboo Creek, because it was a mess when we first saw it.
And this is in the Puget Sound area of Washington, and it's considered one of the highest quality estuaries remaining, yet it was this tract that you're talking about was in a pretty rough shape.
Yeah, so the creek is little. It's only about 7.5 miles long,
okay.
And as you said, it flows into the Pacific Ocean, so that's where the salmon come in. They come in and out of the creek every fall. But when we took it on, there'd been a history of agriculture that had failed. The soils are very poor, and so the commercial farming had ended decades ago. So a lot of these areas along the creek had been ditched and channeled, and the wetlands had been destroyed. But then for agriculture, but then after those operations went belly up, the land was basically fallow.
Mm-hmm. And it had no trees. Is that correct?
All the lowland areas
yeah.
had been cleared, and so they were abandoned pastures or just sort of boggy areas that had been abandoned. There were still commercial forest lands on the upland areas around the creek.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, the whole entire watershed in general had been pretty beat up for about 120 years.
Mm. So the story of salmon, the fish, is one of sort of their. It's kind of this metaphor of courage and determination, you know, like you just mentioned, you know, they go out foraging in the Northeast Pacific Ocean, the ones near you at any rate, the species near you. And then when the waters rise with the rains in late summer or fall, they try to make their way back to the streams of their birth to spawn and create the next generation. Is that, am I oversimplifying? But that's
No, that's
yeah.
exact. And,
okay.
and there's a sort of magical element.
Yeah.
People in the Northeast, if they've seen Atlantic salmon, or people
yeah.
in the Northwest with or California with Pacific salmon, as you say, they just, the creek is empty. You might see the little minnows, the little babies hanging out during the summer. But then in the fall or whenever the timing of the what we call the run, when the adults come back to breed, they just appear. And it's just, as if by magic, these gigantic beasts are running up and down these little creeks.
And so this land, as you two found it in shocking condition, what was wrong that this little piece of water, why didn't it support the salmon? What did you aim to do? What needed healing in that sense?
The basic thing we needed to work on, there were two things. We needed to work on the stream course itself
mm-hmm.
to get it back into a natural, meandering, sinuous sort of shape that had wood in it and lots of gravel for the mom salmon to build their nests in.
Mm.
And then we needed to reforest to replace the trees that had grown in the area historically. So we were really focused on those two things, take care of the water and take care of the trees.
You say in the book, and maybe it's a quote, maybe you're quoting someone else, I'm not sure, you say, with the stream, you needed to make crooked that which was straight, yes?
Yeah, because yeah that's exactly, yeah, that's my line, because it's exactly
yeah.
what you're doing. If you're farming in a wet spot, you want to get the water
ditches.
Down and off and get the soils dry, and we had to do, to bring the fish back, and bring wildlife back, we had to do exactly the opposite. So
right, instead of ditches that in agriculture are used to move the water off,
yes,
and they're
quickly,
straight,
right.
and they're not like nature makes, water doesn't move in nature that way.
Right, they're deep, and you want to bring the water, the stream back up toward the surface so it re-wets the soils and get it wandering back and forth the way it does naturally. So you just, like before we worked on our place, there was about 1,000 feet of the creek. When we were done with this remeandering, there was 1,500. There was just a lot more creek.
So the shortest distance between two points might be a straight line, but it's not the best way to go.
Not the best way.
Yeah.
Not the way the water wants to move.
So you wanted to slow the water and sort of bring it up to the surface and so re-wet the soils that were so desperate, in such desperate condition.
Right. So then you get a complete change in the kind of insect life and plant life and,
right.
and then mammals and birds and everything else follows.
So I'm a gardener. I don't know much about fish. And so I found, as I said at the beginning, you know, I was like, oh, I'm reading a book about fish. And then I realized I wasn't. It's bigger than that. So there's this reforesting as well. And so what really struck me the most in this book was you know, this isn't a story that's particular to the Pacific Northwest or even America, where the land, as you say in the book, settlers led and logging companies followed close behind. You know, this has happened in Europe. That happened, too, hundreds of years before it happened here, right?
That's right.
Yeah. So, but when you went to then not just make the stream better for the salmon, you then went to reforest. You couldn't really look in a historical record and say, ah, here's the palette of plants that we need to regrow from some point in the time in the past, because things have changed. And that's what really interested me. So I wondered if we could talk a little bit about, like, what do you put there? Like, you could find historical records of what grew there, but that's not what you necessarily were going to replant, was it?
Yes, and this is a big conundrum that's being debated among people who do this work. You know, we now call it ecological restoration. It's really just gardening with native plants on a big scale. And so we actually think of ourselves as gardener, you know, the dictum, right plant in the right place.
Because we're imposing something on the land. It didn't just happen. We're, like, a garden is an imposition.
Right,
I mean,
And you often have to manage invasives just the way you're managing weeds in a vegetable or flower. Garden, and our water feature in our big 17-acre garden is this salmon stream.
So there were carcasses or stumps, at least, that gave you a hint of what once grew there. And, for instance, what would some of those plants have been that might have been the old trees that no longer
exist? The iconic trees in this part of the world are western red cedar.
Yeah.
And your listeners may know them because they're used widely for roofing or for the sides of houses. It's wonderfully rot-resistant. And just a gorgeous tree, too, just lacy foliage. It's striking. And then Douglas firs, which are, if your listeners have hefted a 2x4, it's very likely out of Douglas fir from the Pacific Northwest. So those are two of the they were the real grandmothers and grandfathers when settlers found the old-growth forest here.
But you didn't just go and put those back, because the world has changed, hasn't it? The climate has changed.
So,
and so what do you do?
The short answer, honestly, Margaret, nobody knows. We're trying to figure this out on the fly.
Okay.
So initially, like in Susan's grandfather's day in the 1930s, 40s, 50s, up until recently, people said, let's do exactly what you said. Look back at the historical records and put it back. Things seemed to be working well. Soils were good. Water was good. Wildlife was abundant.
Okay.
Let's do that. And now, as you said, that world doesn't exist. Temperatures are higher. Storms are more severe. Fires are in many parts of the world are more frequent and more intense. So we have to shift our framework and think, what is the future going to be like? And so when we sit down to do our plant ordering, just the same way when we do our garden ordering for our vegetable garden we do at home, we have to think, now, you know, we're not planting lettuces and squash that are going to live for 3 months. We're planting cedar trees that could live 1,000 years.
Mm-hmm.
So we've gone through this debate, exactly as you highlighted, about what do we do? Do we plant stuff that's native to California now because we think it's going to be, when our grandkids are grown, that's going to be the appropriate environment? And so we've sort of been dancing around this issue. And as I say in the book, we don't know what's going to happen. We are optimistic people. We believe in action, and we believe in human beings and basic decency and concern for people about the planet. So we've been planting the trees that we think will thrive if we as a community, as a global community, wake up and start to take some reasonable action about climate change.
So you had to choose a strategy, because there is no real roadmap that's a guaranteed roadmap.
That's right. Nobody's done this before.
Right. And so what if one is trying to adjust or adapt for climate change, one would go and pick the plant palette of a more southern ecosystem? Is that right?
Yes, exactly.
Okay.
That's the general pattern, is that plants are moving up in elevation, up mountain size, and north poleward, north and south.
Okay.
And the big extremes, the most extremes on the planet right now in temperature are toward the pole.
And, of course, what's interesting when you say that, it flashes in my head, what we're also seeing, I think, is that insects, everything's spreading further. They're able to move further north because it's more favorable, it seems
exactly.
like.
Exactly, right.
So it's not just the plants that
no.
may be from a more southerly or warmer area, but it's also other creatures that are adapting. And where I assume birds and migratory species go and will come back to and so forth, you know, looking for appropriate habitat as time changes.
Exactly. Our older son is a biologist, and he does research documenting exactly what you just described, of showing that birds are going up mountainsides, and in some cases in the tropics, birds that used to be at the top of mountains in its 1960s or 80s are gone.
Right. And yet you're optimistic. I know you're optimistic, and that's what's so beautiful about this book. One of the things that's so beautiful about this book, and this is part, you're part of Tarpu Creek, your 17 acres is part of a bigger, I should have said that at the beginning, it's not just you in this little piece of land that you, quote, own. This is part of a bigger project, yes?
I mean, that's right, yeah. And it's really what attracted us to this. We were shopping all over Western Washington for mm-hmm. a project like this, and that's really what attracted us to this particular project, is that a little community had started to form saying, what if we worked on this entire watershed as a whole that could be a model for what we could do nationally or even internationally? And that's come to be. That was sort of a seed that was in the ground in 2004 when we started. And now there have been well over 1,000 school kids, I think 1,200, 1,300 school kids who have planted trees in this watershed from all the surrounding villages and communities, and dozens of different government agencies and tribes that have been involved. It's been a wonderful, we've met so many friends through this project. It's been, and you talk about shared values, you know, when you're digging out in the garden and getting worn out and friends or family members are there, you're just thinking, we are really bonding here, working on this place to make it beautiful. And you experience the same sort of thing doing this sort of restoration work.
Mm. And fighting the invasives, how's the bonding over that?
Oh, my goodness. Oh, heavens. That's our current. We had a big, I don't know if your listeners are familiar with reed canary grass. It's famous.
Oh, boy.
All over the
is
country.
Is that a phalaris? Is that what I want to say? What's this genus? I can't remember. Is that a phalaris?
Oh my goodness, reed canary.
I want to say it's a phalaris, but
yeah, I'm having a little
phalaris arundinacea or something like that.
Did
I make that? I might have made that up. Don't anyone believe when Margaret starts talking Latin, okay?
Someone will correct us. Anyway, yeah, we had a big infestation come in one of the areas near the creek, and so yeah, we've been battling that the past couple of years. Making progress. We're gonna win this one.
But, so yeah. Just so people know, it's not like you restore, like you say, we've picked a palette, we've made a decision on our philosophy of the palette according to where we're going to roll the dice about climate change and all the other things that have changed. And then we're going to put in all of our new plants, thousands and thousands of new plants, and we're just going to turn our backs. This is a lifelong commitment and beyond to then help it balance itself until these things take a foothold and hopefully can fight the good fight.
Exactly.
For themselves,
The only constant for us is change. And we're always learning from the plants and from the land and from the wildlife about changes to make, things to try. So it's a wonderfully creative process and very engaging. You have to be sort of thinking along with the land as you go through this. So when we've been giving talks about the book, people will say, well, sort of bring up your point, is they'll say, when is it done? When and Susan and I will often say, that's exactly the point, never.
Yeah.
You know, we're always engaged. We'll always have our hands in this soil.
Yeah. Another great passage for me in the book, it says, if your goal is to live with the land instead of just on it, you have to accept the organisms that live there more or less on their own terms. So, for instance, you give the example of, you know, if someone wants to have a lot of lawn and then they want to scream and shout and stamp their feet that there are moles who decide that that seems like a very nice place to do their mole thing, it's kind of like you really can't say no moles, put up a sign that says, excuse me, moles, you're not welcome here, even though I planted this big tract of turf grass, you know.
Uh-huh.
Or with your pools that the female salmon would enjoy, you know, and would have the right situation for them to breed in, to make their nests in. Someone else may come, an otter may come, right?
Yes.
And does.
And this really became a big, we were confronted with exactly this issue when beavers moved in. Because they started damming the stream, and they started eating our little saplings we'd planted so lovingly, or that school kids had put out with their parents. And so we started a process of, you know, and we talked to a lot of friends and folks in our circle, and everyone said, get rid of them. Just, you know, beavers are bad. They'll destroy everything.
Yeah.
And we went back to what that quote you just said, is that we've got to learn to live with them. They've been here way longer than we have. Beavers and salmon have coexisted since time immemorial. And actually, beavers create wonderful salmon habitat. So it was sort of ecologically really made sense for us to make it work. But we wanted to regrow this forest. We had to learn how to protect the plants and how to sort of manage the restoration with the beavers.
Mm-hmm. It's funny, I've been stamping my feet out in the backyard. I have a couple of, you know, contrivances, water gardens that have been in the ground for, I don't know, 30 years or something. And usually I have lots and lots and lots of amphibians and lots of frogs, especially in at the water's edge. And this year I have one very, very large female bullfrog. And she has gradually, often in front of me as if to challenge me on this theory that I just quoted you. she has eaten almost everyone else. You know, she's had for lunch everybody else.
We have a real problem with bullfrogs.
Yeah.
They're exotic.
Yeah. No, they're exotic for you. But and normally I have, you know, the greens and the bulls and the wood frogs. And I have everybody and a couple species, three species of salamanders and whatever. Everybody's in these little pieces of water. And everybody sort of survives. And sometimes somebody eats somebody. But anyway, and I want to put her in a net and cart her down the road to some bigger stream and say, get out of my yard and stop doing this. But on the other hand, you know what? I can't do that, right? I have to let it play itself out. And I mean, it's just a tiny example in a contrivance of a garden, you know. But it's a very important point for people to think about. If your goal is to live with the land instead of just on it, you have to accept the organisms that live there more or less on their own terms. To quote
I'd
you
make,
again.
I'd make friends with your local great blue heron and let her know there's a wonderful dinner waiting.
She's a hefty girl, that
frog. That's right. That would be dinner and breakfast, so, leftovers.
So the book ends with a sort of invocation to live a natural life. And you have a few, you know, in the last minute or two, I just wanted to say, can you kind of give us that sort of invocation? What are the tenets of it?
Yeah, I was inspired by the Beatitudes out of the mm-hmm. these beautiful declarations out of the New Testament mm-hmm. about how people can think about living and wanted to do something similar about our relationship with the natural world. And what I came up with was four. One, the first is be engaged, and mm-hmm. that's what your audience does by gardening and raising food or flowers or making a place beautiful. And then the other three were to be present, and that's just to sit and put your phone down and experience the people around you and the natural world around you in a real way. And then the next one is to be real, which is, I think, epidemic. We're coached in our culture all the time to judge ourselves by the size of our house and our car and our TV set. And I just ask readers to consider putting that away, at least a little bit, and judging themselves by the quality of their relationships with each other and the land around them. And the last one is to be simple, and that's just an invocation about how the decisions you make about your life, you know, the size of your car, what you're eating, are you growing some of your own food, just the sort of the stuff in your life.
The stuff. And it's easy to let that take over, isn't it?
That's right, and we're constantly bombarded with the messages in a consumer culture that we live in, that this is where value is in life, and that's empty for us, really. And because what we value is when we serve each other and serve the land and connect with each other and connect with the land, that's where the real value in life lies.
Well said. So the book is Scott Freeman's new book is Saving Tarbu Creek, One Family's Quest to Heal the Land. And I'm so glad to speak to you. Thank you so much for making the time today. And thanks for the book.
Thank you, Margaret. And thanks for your beautiful work.
Okay.
Underwriting support from Timber Press, your go-to resource for books in gardening and nature. Whether you're a new gardener, a professional at the top of your field, or a reader interested in the wonders of the natural world, their books are there to help you grow. TimberPress.com.
I hope to speak to all the rest of you again soon. Now, don't miss an episode. You can subscribe free on the podcast version. Get it from Stitcher or iTunes. You can find me anytime at awaytogarden.com or facebook.com/awaytogarden, and happy gardening meantime.
A Way to Garden with Margaret Roach is a joint production of awaytogarden.com and the smallest NPR station in the nation, Robin Hood Radio.